Corporal the Right Honourable the Earl of Onk Nobby Nobbs pushed open the watch-house door and staggered inside. Sergeant Colon looked up from the desk and gasped. "You okay, Nobby?" he said, hurrying around to support the swaying figure.
"It's terrible, Fred. Terrible. Here, take a seat. You're all pale." "I've been elevated, Fred," moaned Nobby. "Nasty. Did you see who did it?"
Nobby wordlessly handed him the scroll Dragon King of Arms had pressed into his hand, and flopped back. He took a tiny length of homemade cigarette from behind his ear and lit it with a shaking hand.
"I dunno, I'm sure," he said. "You do your best. You keep your head down, you don't make any trouble, and then something like this happens to you."
Colon read the scroll slowly, his lips moving when he came to difficult words like and the.
"Nobby, you've read this? It says, you're a lord. The old man said they'd have to do a lot of checking up, but he thought it was pretty clear what with the ring and all. Fred, what am I going to do? Sit back and eat off of him in plates, I should think. That's just it, Fred. There's no money, no big house, no land, not a brass farthing."
"What, nothing?"
"Not a dried pea, Fred.
I thought all the upper crust had pots of money."
"Well, I'm the crust on its uppers, Fred. I don't know anything about lording. I don't want to have to wear posh clothes and go to hunt bulls and all that stuff."
Sergeant Colon sat down beside him.
"You never suspected you got any posh connections?"
"Well, my cousin Vincent once got done for indecently assaulting the Duchess of Quirm's housemaid."
"Chambermaid or scullery maid?"
"Scullery maid, I think."
"Probably doesn't count, then. Does anyone else know about all this?"
"Well, she did, and she went and told—"
"I mean about your lordshipping?"
"Only Mr. Vimes."
"Well, there you are," said Sergeant Colon, handing him back the scroll. "You don't have to tell anyone." "Then you don't have to go around wearing golden trousers, and you needn't hunt balls unless you've lost them. You just sit there and I'll fetch you a cup of tea. How about that? We'll see it through, don't you worry." "You're a tough, Fred. That makes two of us, my lord." Colon waggled his eyebrows. "Get it? Get it?"
"Don't, Fred," said Nobby wearily.
The watch-house door opened. Fog poured in like smoke. In the midst of it were two red eyes. The parting shreds revealed the massive figure of a golem.
"Ugh,"
said Sergeant Colon. The golem held up its slate.
"I have come to you."
Yeah, I can see that," said Colon.
Dorful turned the slate round. The other side read,
"I give myself up for murder. It was I who killed the old priest. The crime is solved."
Colon, once his lips had stopped moving, scurried behind the suddenly very flimsy defences of his desk and scrabbled through the papers there.
"You keep it covered, Nobby," he said. "Make sure it don't run off."
"Why is it going to run off?" said Nobby.
Sergeant Colon found a relatively clean piece of paper.
What's your name?"
The golem wrote,
"Dorful."
By the time he was on the brass bridge, medium-sized cobbles of the rounded sort they called catheads, quite a few missing, Vimes was already beginning to wonder if he'd done the right thing. Autumn fogs were always thick, but he'd never known it this bad. The pall muffled the sounds of the city and turned the brightest lights into dim glows, even though in theory the sun hadn't set yet. He walked along by the parapet. A squat, glistening shape loomed in the fog. It was one of the wooden hippos, some distant ancestor of Roderick or Keith. There were four on either side, all looking out towards the sea. Vimes had walked past them thousands of times. They were old friends. He'd often stood in the lee of one on chilly nights when he was looking for somewhere out of trouble. That's what it used to be like, wasn't it? It hardly seemed that long ago, just a handful of them in the watch, staying out of trouble. And then Carrot had arrived, and suddenly the narrow circuit of their lives had opened up. And there were nearly 30 men, including trolls and dwarfs and miscellaneous, in the watch now. And they didn't skulk around keeping out of trouble. They went looking for trouble, and they found it everywhere they looked. Funny, that. As Vetinari had pointed out in that way of his, the more policemen you had, the more crimes seemed to be committed. But the watch was back and out there on the streets, and if they weren't actually as good as detritus at kicking arse, they were definitely prodding buttock. He lit a match on a hippo's toenail and cupped his hand around it to shield his cigar from the damp. These murders, now. No one would care if the watch didn't care. Two old men murdered on the same day, nothing stolen. He'd corrected himself, nothing apparently stolen. Of course, the thing about things that were stolen was that the bloody things weren't there. They almost certainly hadn't been fooling around with other people's wives. They probably couldn't remember what fooling around was. One spent his time among old religious books. The other, for God's sakes, was an authority on the aggressive uses of baking. People would probably say they had lived blameless lives. But Vimes was a policeman. No one lived a completely blameless life. It might be just possible, by lying very still in a cellar somewhere, to get through a day without committing a crime, but only just, and even then you were probably guilty of loitering. Anyway, Angua seemed to have taken this case personally. She always had a soft spot for the underdog. So did Vimes. You had to, not because they were pure or noble, because they weren't. You had to be on the side of underdogs, because they weren't overdogs. Everyone in this city looked after themselves. That's what the guilds were for. People banded together against other people. The guilds looked after you from the cradle to the grave, or in the case of the assassins, to other people's graves. They even maintained the law, or at least they had done, after a fashion. Thieving without a license was punishable by death for the first offence. The Ankh-Morpork view of crime and punishment was that the penalty for the first offence should prevent the possibility of a second offence. The Thieves' Guild saw to that. The arrangement sounded unreal, but it worked. It worked like a machine. That was fine, except for the occasional people who got crushed in the wheels. The damp cobbles felt reassuringly real under his soles. God, he'd missed this. He'd patrolled alone in the old days. When there was just him, and the stones glistened around 3 a.m, it all seemed to make sense somehow. He stopped. Around him the world became a crystal of horror, the special horror that has nothing to do with fangs, or ichor, or ghosts, but has everything to do with the familiar becoming unfamiliar. Something fundamental was wrong. It took a few dreadful seconds for his mind to supply the details of what his subconscious had noticed. There had been 5 statues along the parapet on this side. But there should have been 4. He turned very slowly and walked back to the last one. It was a hippo, all right. So was the next one. There was graffiti on it. Nothing supernatural had "Zaz is a Wonka" scrawled on it. It seemed to him that it didn't take quite so long to get to the next one, and when he looked at it, 2 red points of light flared in the fog above him. Something big and dark leapt down, knocked him to the ground, and disappeared into the gloom. Vimes struggled to his feet, shook his head, and set off after it. No thought was involved. It is the ancient instinct of terriers and policemen to chase anything that runs away. And as he ran, he felt automatically for his bell, which would summon other watchmen. But the commander of the watch didn't carry a bell. Commanders of the watch were on their own. In Vimes's squalid office, Captain Carrot stared at a piece of paper. Repairs to guttering, watch house, Pseudopolis Yard. New downpipe, 35 degrees, Micklewhite Bend, 4 right-angled trusses, labour and making good, $16.35. There were more like them, including Constable Downspout's pigeon bill. He knew Sergeant Colon objected to the idea of a policeman being paid in pigeons, but Constable Downspout was a gargoyle, and gargoyles had no concept of money. But they knew a pigeon when they ate it. Still, things were improving. When Carrot had arrived, the entire watch's petty cash had been kept on a shelf in a tin marked "Strong in the Arms Armour Polish for Gleaming Cohorts." And if money was needed for anything, all you had to do was go and find Nobby and force him to give it back. Then there was a letter from a resident in Park Lane, one of the most select addresses in the city. "Commander Vimes, the night watch patrol in this street appears to be made up entirely of dwarfs. I have nothing against dwarfs among their own kind, at least they are not trolls, but one hears stories, and I have daughters in the house, I demand that this situation is remedied instantly, otherwise I shall have no option but to take up the matter with Lord Vetinari, who is a personal friend. I am, sir, your obedient servant, Joshua H. Catterail. This was police work, was it? He wondered if Mr. Vimes were trying to tell him something. There were other letters. The community coordinator of Equal Heights for Dwarfs was demanding that dwarfs in the watch be allowed to carry an axe rather than the traditional sword, and should be sent to investigate only those crimes committed by tall people. The Thieves' Guild was complaining that Commander Vimes had said publicly that most thefts were committed by thieves. You'd need the wisdom of King Isaiah Danu to tackle them, and these were only today's letters. He picked up the next one and read, "Translation of text found in Father Tubalchek's mouth, Y.S.V." Carrot dutifully read the translation. "In his mouth? Someone tried to put words in his mouth?" said Carrot to the silent room. He shivered, but not because of the cold that came from fear. Vimes's office was always cold. Vimes was an outdoors person. Fog was dancing in the open window, little fingers of it drifting in the light. The next paper down the heap was a copy of Cheery's iconograph. Carrot stared at the two blurred red eyes. "Captain Carrot?" He half turned his head, but kept looking at the picture. "Yes, Fred?" "We've got the murderer. We've got him."
"Is he a golem?"
"How did you know that?" The tincture of night began to suffuse the soup of the afternoon. Lord Vetinari considered the sentence, and found it good. He liked tincture particularly. Tincture. Tincture. It was a distinguished word, and pleasantly countered by the flatness of soup. The soup of the afternoon. Yes, in which may well be found the croutons of tea-time. He was aware that he was a little light-headed. He'd never have thought a sentence like that in a normal frame of mind. In the fog outside the window, just visible by the candlelight, he saw the crouching shape of Constable Downspout. A gargoyle, huh? He'd wondered why the watch was indented for 5 pigeons a week on its wages bill. A gargoyle in the watch whose job it was to watch. That would be Captain Carrot's idea. Lord Vetinari got up carefully from the bed and closed the shutters. He walked slowly to his writing table, pulled his journal out of its drawer, then tugged out a wad of manuscript and unstoppered the ink bottle. Now then, where had he got to? Chapter 8, he read unsteadily. The Rights of Man. Ah, yes. "Concerning truth," he wrote, "that which may be spoken as events dictate, but should be heard on every occasion." He wondered how he could work soup of the afternoon into the treatise, or at least tincture of night. The pen scratched across the paper. Unheeded on the floor lay the tray that had contained a bowl of nourishing gruel, concerning which he had resolved to have strong words with the cook when he felt better. It had been tasted by 3 tasters, including Sergeant Detritus, who was unlikely to be poisoned by anything that worked on humans, or even by most things that worked on trolls, but probably by most things that worked on trolls. The door was locked. Occasionally he could hear the reassuring creak of Detritus on his rounds. Outside the window the fog condensed on Constable Downspout. Vetinari dipped the pen in the ink and started a new page. Every so often he consulted the leather-bound journal, licking his fingers delicately to turn the thin pages. Tendrils of fog slipped in around the shutters and brushed against the wall until they were frightened away by the candlelight. Vimes pounded through the fog after the fleeing figure. It wasn't quite so fast as him, despite the twinges in his legs and 1 or 2 warning stabs from his left knee, but whenever he came close to it, some muffled pedestrian got in the way, or a cart pulled out of a cross street. As always happens in any police chase anywhere, a heavily laden lorry will always pull out of a side alley in front of the pursuit. If vehicles aren't involved, then it'll be a man with a rack of garments, or 2 men with a large sheet of glass. There's probably some kind of secret society behind all this. His souls told him that they'd gone right down Broadway and had turned left into Nonsuch Street, small square paving stones. The fog was even thicker here, trapped between the trees of the park. But Vimes was triumphant. "You've missed your turning if you're heading for the Shades, my lad. There's only the Ankh Bridge now, and there'll be a guard on that." His feet told him something else. They said, wet leaves. That's none such street in the autumn. Small square paving stones with occasional treacherous drifts of wet leaves. They said it too late. Vimes landed on his chin in the gutter, staggered upright, fell over again as the rest of the universe spun past, got up, tottered a few steps in the wrong direction, fell over again, and decided to accept the majority vote for a while. Dorful was standing quietly in the station office, heavy arms folded across its chest. In front of the golem was the crossbow belonging to Sergeant Tritus, which had been converted from an ancient siege weapon. It fired a 6-foot-long iron arrow. Nobby sat behind it, his finger on the trigger.
"Put it away, Nobby. You can't fire that in here," said Carrot. "You know we never find where the arrows stop."
"We wrestled a confession out of it," said Sergeant Colon, hopping up and down. "It kept on admitting it, but we got it to confess in the end. And we've got those other crimes we'd like taken into consideration."
Dorful held up its slate.
"I am guilty."
Something fell out of its hand. It was short and white, a piece of matchstick by the look of it. Carrot picked it up and stared at it. Then he looked at the list Colon had drawn up. It was quite long and consisted of every unsolved crime in the city for the past couple of months.
"It's confessed to all these?"
"Not yet," said Nobby. "We haven't read 'em all out yet," said Colon.
Dorful wrote,
"I did everything."
"Hey," said Colon, "Mr. Vimes is going to be really pleased with us."
Carrot walked up to the golem. There was a faint orange glow in its eyes. "Did you kill Father Tubalcheck?" he said.
"Yes."
"See," said Sergeant Colon, "you can't argue with that."
"Why did you do it?" said Carrot. No reply.
"And Mr. Hopkinson at the Bread Museum?"
"Yes."
"You beat him to death with an iron bar?" said Carrot.
"Yes."
"Hang on," said Colon. "I thought you said he was..."
"Leave it, Fred," said Carrot.
"Why did you kill the old man, Dorful?"
No reply.
"Does there have to be a reason? You can't trust golems, my dad always used to say," said Colon. "Turn on you as soon as look at you," he said.
"Have they ever killed anyone?" said Carrot.
"Not for want of thinking about it," said Colon, darkly. "My dad said he had to work with one once, and it used to look at him all the time. He'd turn around, and there it would be, looking at him."
Dorful sat staring straight in front.
"Shine a candle in its eyes," said Nobby.
Carrot pulled a chair across the floor and straddled it facing Dorful. He absent-mindedly twirled the broken match between his fingers.
"I know you didn't kill Mr. Hopkinson, and I don't think you killed Father Tubalcheck," he said. "I think he was dying when you found him. I think you tried to save him, Dorful. In fact, I'm pretty sure I can prove it if I can see your chem."
The light from the golem's flaring eyes filled the room. He stepped forward, fists upraised. Nobby fired the crossbow. Dorful snatched the long bolt out of the air. There was the sound of screaming metal, and the bolt became a thin bar of red-hot iron with a bulge piled up around the golem's grip. But Carrot was behind the golem, flipping open its head. As the golem turned, raising the iron bar like a club, the fire died in its eyes.
"Got it," said Carrot, holding up a yellowed scroll.
At the end of Nonsuch Street was a gibbet, where wrongdoers, or at least people found guilty of wrongdoing, had been hung to twist gently in the wind as examples of just retribution, and as the elements took their toll, basic anatomy as well. Once parties of children were brought there by their parents to learn by dreadful example of the snares and perils that await the criminal, the outlaw, and those who happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they would see the terrible wreckage creaking on its chain and listen to the stern imprecations, and then usually, this being Ankh Morpork, would say, "Wow! Brilliant!" and use the corpse as a swing. These days the city had more private and efficient ways of dealing with those it found surplus to requirements. But for the sake of tradition, the gibbet's incumbent was a quite realistic wooden body. The occasional stupid raven would have a peck at the eyeballs even now and end up with a much shorter beak. Vimes tottered up to it, fighting for breath. The quarry could have gone anywhere by now. Such daylight as had been filtering through the fog had given up. Vimes stood beside the gibbet, which creaked. It had been built to creak. What's the good of a public display of retribution, it had been argued, if it didn't creak ominously? In richer times, an elderly man had been employed to operate the creak by means of a length of string. But now there was a clockwork mechanism that needed to be wound up only once a month. Condensation dripped off the artificial corpse.
"Blow this for a lark," muttered Vimes, and tried to head back the way he came.
After 10 seconds of blundering, he tripped over something. It was a wooden corpse, hurled into the gutter. When he got back to the gibbet, the empty chain was swinging gently, jingling in the fog. Sergeant Colan tapped the golem's chest. It went donk.
"Like a flower pot," said Nobby. "How can they move around when they're like a pot, eh? They ought to keep cracking all the time." "They're daft, too," said Colan. "I heard there was one over in Quirm who was made to dig a trench, and they forgot all about it, and they only remembered it when there was all this water because it had dug all the way to the river."
Carrot unrolled the chem on the table and laid beside it the paper that had been put in Father Tubalcheck's mouth.
"It's dead, is it?"
said Sergeant Colan.
"It's harmless," said Carrot, looking from one piece of paper to the other.
"Right. I've got a sledgehammer round the back somewhere. I'll just..."
"No," said Carrot.
"You saw the way it was acting."
"I don't think it could actually have hit me. I think it just wanted to scare us."
"It worked.
Look at these, Fred."
Sergeant Colan glanced at the desk.
"Foreign writing," he said,
in a voice which suggested that it was nothing like as good as decent home writing, and probably smelled of garlic.
"Anything strike you about them?"
"Well, they looks the same,"
Sergeant Colan conceded.
"This yellowing one is Dorfel's chem. The other one is from Father Tubalcheck," said Carrot.
"Letter for letter the same."
"Why's that?" "I think Dorfel wrote these words and put them in old Tubalcheck's mouth after the poor man died," said Carrot slowly,
still looking from one piece of paper to the other.
"Ugh, yuck," said Nobby. "That's mucky, that is."
"No, you don't understand," said Carrot. "I mean he wrote them because they were the only ones he knew that worked."
"Worked how?"
"Well, you know, the kiss of life," said Carrot. "I mean, first aid."
"I know you know, Nobby. You came with me when they had that course at the YMPA. "I only went because you said you got a free cup of tea and a biscuit," said Nobby sulkily. "Anyway, the dummy ran away when it was my turn."
"It's the same with life-saving, too," said Carrot. "We want people to breathe, so we try to make sure they've got some air in them."
They all turned to look at the golem.
"But golems don't breathe," said Colan.
"No, a golem knows only one thing that keeps you alive," said Carrot. "It's the words in your head."
They all turned back to look at the words. They all turned to look at the statue that was Dorfel.
"It's gone all cold in here," Nobby quavered. "I definitely felt an aura flickering in the air just then. It was like someone..."
"What's going on?" said Vimes, shaking the damp off his cloak.
"Opening the door," said Nobby.
It was 10 minutes later. Sergeant Colan and Nobby had gone off duty to everyone's relief. Colan, in particular, had great difficulty with the idea that you went on investigating after someone had confessed. It outraged his training and experience. You got a confession, and there it ended. You didn't go around disbelieving people. You disbelieved people only when they said they were innocent. Only guilty people were trustworthy. Anything else struck at the whole basis of policing.
"White clay," said Carrot. "It was white clay we found, and practically unbaked. Dorfel's made of dark terracotta and rock hard."
"The last thing the old priest saw was a golem," said Vimes.
"Dorfel, I'm sure," said Carrot, "but that's not the same as saying Dorfel was the murderer. I think he turned up as the man was dying, that's all."
"Oh, why?"
"I'm not sure yet, but I've seen Dorfel around. He's always seemed a very gentle person."
"It works in a slaughterhouse."
"Maybe that's not a bad place for a gentle person to work, sir," said Carrot. "Anyway, I've checked up all the records I can find, and I don't think a golem has ever attacked anyone, or committed any kind of crime."
"Oh, come on," said Vimes. "Everyone knows."
He stopped as his cynical ears heard his incredulous voice.
"What, never?"
"Oh, people are always saying that they know someone who has a friend whose grandfather heard of one killing someone, and that's about as real as it gets, sir. Golems aren't allowed to hurt people, it's in their words."
"They give me the willies, I know that," said Vimes.
"They give everyone the willies, sir. You hear lots of stories about them doing stupid things like making 1,000 teapots, or digging a hole 5 miles deep," said Vimes.
"Yes, but that's not exactly criminal activity, is it, sir? That's just ordinary rebellion."
"What do you mean, rebellion?" dumbly obeying orders, sir. You know, someone shouts at it, go and make teapots, so it does. Can't be blamed for obeying orders, sir. No one told them how many. No one wants them to think, so they get their own back by not thinking. They rebel by working. It's just a thought, sir. It'd make more sense to a golem, I expect. Automatically, they turned again to look at the silent shape of the golem. Can it hear us? Said Vimes. I don't think so, sir. This business with the words. I think they think a dead human is just someone who's lost his kin. I don't think they understand how we work, sir. Them and me both, Captain. Vimes stared at the hollow eyes. The top of Dorfel's head was still open so that light shone down through the sockets. Vimes had seen many horrible things on the street, but the silent golem was somehow worse. You could too easily imagine the eyes flaring and the thing standing up and striding forward, fists flailing like sledgehammers. It was more than just his imagination. It seemed to be built into the things, a potentiality biding its time. That's why we all hate him, he thought. Those expressionless eyes watch us, those big faces turn to follow us. And doesn't it just look as if they're making notes and taking names? If you heard that one had bashed in someone's head over in Quirm or somewhere, wouldn't you just love to believe it? A voice inside, a voice which generally came to him only in the quiet hours of the night, or in the old days halfway down a whiskey bottle, added, "Given how we use them, maybe we're scared because we know we deserve it." No, there's nothing behind those eyes. There's just clay and magic words. Vimes shrugged. I chased a golem earlier, he said. It was standing on the brass bridge, damned thing. Look, we've got a confession and the eyeball evidence. If you can't come up with anything better than a feeling, then we'll have to...
To what, sir? Said Carrot.
There isn't anything more we could do to him. He's dead now. Inanimate, you mean? Yes, sir, if you want to put it that way. If Dorfel didn't kill the old men, who did? Don't know, sir, but I think Dorfel does. Maybe he was following the murderer. Could it have been ordered to protect someone? Maybe, sir. Or he decided to. You'll be telling me it's got emotions next. Where's Angua gone? She thought she'd check a few things, sir, said Carrot. I was puzzled about this, sir. It was in his hand. He held up the object. A piece of matchstick? Golems don't smoke, and they don't use fire, sir. It's just odd that he should have the thing, sir.
Oh, said Vimes sarcastically, a clue.